From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Last week, the CDC reported an increase in suicides across the country between 1999 and 2016. Here in Georgia, suicide deaths rose 16% in that same period. Those findings were released the same week fashion designer Kate Spade and celebrity chef Anthony Bourdain took their own lives. People who work in suicide prevention and research have been following the rise in these studies, among them my guests, Emory University professor Nadine Caslow. She's former president of the American Psychological Association, and she studies the causes and effects of suicide. Dr. Caslow, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Doreen Marshall is also joining us. She's vice president of programs at the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Hello, Doreen.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, Nadine, you've done research into suicide for more than 20 years. We find in this report the 10th leading cause of death in the U.S. Anything surprising to you in this report?
Well, one of the things that was most concerning is that the rates of death by suicide are rising essentially all over the country. And they're rising in all groups of individuals, women, men, and people of every age group. So that was extremely disturbing and concerning to me. The other major finding that I think is important to note is that over half the individuals in this report did not have a diagnosed psychiatric disorder or mental disorder. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't have one, but they didn't have one that was diagnosed. And it really highlights that other factors, such as the loss of a relationship, financial concerns, job difficulties, loss of a job, and substance use problems are extremely important to consider when we're thinking about who's at risk to die by suicide.
Right. So before we get to that, I'm wondering about some states. The rise was nearly 60%, as we said, in Georgia only 16%. But does that rise account for population growth?
Yes, that rise does account for population growth. Absolutely.
So, Doreen, I want to get to that point of more than half among people with previously no known mental condition. Now, that runs against many of the things that we've been told about the warning signs. So is everybody at risk?
Well, no. I think we still have to pay attention to mental health concerns as a primary driver. But I think what the data shows us is that we really need to improve mental health literacy. Like Dr. Caslow said, those numbers that were not diagnosed or had no known mental health disorder may tell us more about people's understanding of mental health disorders, as well as just the complexity of suicide that other factors do contribute.
What then are some of the warning signs?
Well, I think we should all pay attention to someone who is demonstrating a behavior change, severe mood swings, intense rage or anger, and behaviors that are not typical for them. Certainly talking about death or indicating significant hopelessness, a desire not to go on living or feeling like there's no purpose in their life. Certainly any steps to attain lethal means, such as purchasing a gun when someone is in a worsening mood state or trying to get access to those things that might hurt them. We do want to pay attention to other things like worsening substance abuse, intense life stressors, because as Dr. Caslow pointed out, those were also indicated in the report.
Well, let's look at some of the risk factors. And of course, last week, these two celebrity deaths or celebrity suicides came out the same week of this report. Many people stunned by Chef Anthony Bourdain is now confirmed suicide. He had been vocal about his recovery from substance abuse and heroin addiction. Here he is from the PBS NewsHour.
I wanted to become a heroin addict. I was very proud of myself when I first shot up. I was a vulnerable, goofy, awkward guy whose only success socially was to be the baddest guy in the room.
So he was open about that. Addicts, in recovery, there's a will to live, but are addicts, Nadine, at a higher risk?
Well, the research definitely shows that people with substance use problems and are at increased risk for death by suicide and for suicide attempts, and that often people use alcohol or drugs right before they try to kill themselves or die by suicide. So the answer is definitely yes.
Kate Spade, she had struggled with depression, had been in treatment, according to family members. Yet, to the outside, both of these people appeared to have success. They had families, they had careers, young kids, what a lot of people consider perfect lives. Doreen, the perfect life on the outside, is somebody likely suffering on the inside?
Well, they could be, and I think that's the point, is to really not assume that someone is not struggling just because of how things look on the outside. I think we really have to be proactive, not only about our own health and mental health, but also about others and asking those questions, you know, how are you doing? And if we're suspecting that someone's having thoughts of suicide, to ask that directly is so important, because I do think appearances can be deceiving and we don't want to make assumptions about how someone is doing internally by their external state.
Well, you said thoughts of suicide. Can you distinguish for me the difference between suicidal ideation and suicide attempts, for example, which are one of the indicators of somebody who might commit suicide? Nadine, maybe to you.
Sure. So suicidal ideation, or the other word for that is suicidal thoughts. So you're thinking about dying, you're thinking about killing yourself or dying by suicide, you're thinking about harming yourself. Those are the thoughts. Attempts are when you actually try something. You actually make a step toward ending your life. So that might be overdosing or running out in front of traffic or things like that. Whereas death by suicide is when you actually engage in an act that ends your life.
I see.
So there's a continuum there.
Both of you are using this term death by suicide, and I see from reading up on Doreen's organization that you avoid using the term committing suicide. So how does how we talk about suicide influence the way that we think about it?
I would say absolutely. And one of the things my organization, the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, focuses on is improving the way we talk about it. So making sure that those who report on suicide are using correct language. We refrain from terms that convey judgment because we do see suicide as a health issue. So removing terms that may convey judgment, such as committing suicide, we really try and focus on using language that's neutral so that it doesn't negatively affect those who have been impacted.
That's Doreen Marshall of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. I'm speaking with her and with Nadine Kaslow. She's an Emory University professor. She's done a great deal of research on suicide. And we're talking about the dramatic rise in suicide rates in Georgia and nationwide. And want to note, if you or somebody needs help, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline number is 1-800-273-8255. Well, that language, that judgment, that speaks to the idea of how people perceive suicide. Now, Kate Spade, she was 55, Anthony Bourdain, 61. What does the research tell us about suicide among middle-aged people?
Well, in recent years, there's a number of studies that have emerged that have shown us that people in the middle-aged are at increasing risk for death by suicide. And this has been very, very disturbing to find, and this is true for both men and for women.
How about age, race, class? You know, there was a few years ago, or last year, I'm not sure exactly when it was, when Netflix put out this 13 Reasons Why. It's a popular YA novel considered to glamorize suicide. How does that affect public perception?
Well, we certainly have seen in the recent CDC study that you mentioned that they talk about individuals who die by suicide starting at age 10, and we're seeing increased rates among adolescents on upward. But there was also another report that was released this past week as well that compared suicide rates in younger people, in children ages 5 to 12, and actually found that although historically people who are white or Caucasian have had much higher rates of death by suicide than people who are African American, in this very young age group, we're seeing that African American children are dying by suicide more than white children. So this is a problem across the lifespan. It looks different at different ages based on factors like race and gender.
Now, during the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline said calls have spiked by 25% within last week. Is that usual in the wake of celebrity deaths by suicide?
I think it is usual to see some increase of people reaching out. Some of that is that the media coverage has included the Lifeline number, so more people are being exposed to the information, which is a good thing. We shouldn't assume that there's been a rise in suicidal thoughts or a rise in people needing the helpline as much as there's been more people exposed to it and more people willing to reach out, which could be a very good thing.
The CDC did report that overall firearms are the most common method of suicide. Doreen, part of your work, a big part of it, is about prevention. Where does access to a method of suicide figure into prevention?
Well, I think access, particularly access to a firearm, does not allow a lot of time for intervention, for the person to maybe change their mind, for someone to interrupt them. The highly lethal methods like firearm are the ones we worry the most about because it gives us the least amount of time to intervene. So our work, we do focus on promoting safe storage of firearms and when necessary, temporary removal of firearms from a person at risk, because we believe that that helps us in terms of giving us time for the person to get treatment or to get help.
Tell me more about this idea of intervening. Can it make a difference? Somebody just saying something, doing something, showing up at the moment when somebody's considering suicide?
I believe that that can make a huge difference, that people stepping in to try to help, to be with the person, let them know they care about the person, to help them access resources, maybe even calling the hotline with them or taking them to a mental health professional or to their other kind of healthcare provider, can actually make all the difference in the world.
Is there a greater risk for people who've had somebody who committed, who killed themselves within their family?
There is some increased risk if you've lost someone close to you, but risk is never focused on just one factor. So while we know that people who have had a loved one die by suicide are at some increased risk versus people who have never had that experience, we never focus on just one factor. And obviously other factors contribute to a great deal, maybe even more so than that one factor.
So connection to other people, this is something that is increasingly talked about in the social media age, that we are social yet not social. Do you think that that may have anything to do with this increase in suicide rates?
I think that the way people connect through social media, it can be positive and it can be challenging in that, you know, people are often will reach out on social media, particularly if they're struggling. And, you know, certainly we want to encourage people to pay attention to those who might be reaching out on social media. But like Dr. Kaslow said, there are a few things better than a direct contact, a phone call, a visiting of someone that you're concerned about. Those things actually, I think, have a greater impact than just focusing on connections through social media.
Dr. Kaza, we have just 20 seconds. Do you have anything to follow up there?
So I would absolutely agree with that. Again, social support is one of the biggest protective factors for people, and there is help out there. There's lots of help out there. I know that sometimes it's difficult to access that help, but you need to help your loved ones persist in getting the help they need, because there is good help out there.
Emory Professor Nadine Kaslow, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
She's former president of the American Psychological Association. And Doreen Marshall, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Doreen is from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And again, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 800-273-8255. And just ahead, how the media covers suicide and some theories of how it should. But first, we're going to share the story of one mother whose son took his own life. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about the dramatic rise in suicides in the country and here in Georgia, where suicide is the 11th leading cause of death. Sharenza Eccles is from Fairburn. Her son, Marquise Tobert, killed himself on October 3rd of 2012. Sharenza, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And I'm so sorry for your loss.
Thank you also, again.
Can you take us back to that day, October 3rd of 2012?
Yes, I can. Actually, I could take you to the second, if that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
The day before.
Yes. He was in a military school down in Augusta, Georgia, down at Fort Gordon. And while he was down there, he was only gone away from home for like 9 days. He had written letters. The first letter he wrote He was basically telling me he wanted us to come down for family fun day, for us to attend, to spend time with him. Then he wrote a second letter. In the second letter, he was just talking about how it was so bad at the school that it made him want to commit suicide.
Had he ever said anything like that before?
No. And then he had also written a third letter. In the third letter, it said that it's so bad down at that school, it made him want to commit suicide. And, you know, they tell us that sometimes when the kids say things like that, it's just a scare tactic.
Yeah.
Just for the parents to come and pick them up. But had I known what I know now, I would have picked him up sooner.
Did he say why he didn't want to be there at Fort Gordon?
No.
So no clues at all?
No.
And did the school reach out to you and say anything?
No, ma'am.
So, Marquise, on the day that he actually committed suicide, you found a tweet that he'd made. Can you read that to us?
Yes. The tweet says, "Sometimes we need to be hurt in order to grow. We must lose in order to gain. Sometimes some lessons are learned best through pain."
So this is a pretty sharp decline. You said in 9 days he was down there?
Yes, ma'am.
So he left, you know, sort of happy-go-lucky kid, or was he just a typical teenager, I'm wondering?
No, he was a happy-go-lucky kid. He was always just a bright person. He would brighten up the room, give you a smile. You would just get a $1 million smile out of him. He was no different from any other kid. He was just a kid growing up, trying to live life.
Why did he decide to go to that military school in Augusta?
Well, he wanted to come out of school because he wanted to graduate the same year the rest of his friends did. And he was like a year behind in school. But, you know, he wanted to come out the same year his friends were coming out of school, which was 2013. But, you know, sometimes things happen and we never know why. But as a parent, you know, I would say to reach out to your kids.
So in those days, when you found him at home, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
So you had brought him home from the school and then that is where he killed himself?
Yes, ma'am. On that day, it's like, I had gotten, like, several phone calls. I had gotten a phone call from my mom, and it was telling that my brother's stepmom had passed. And then I had gotten another phone call from my alarm company telling me that my battery in my home was weak, not knowing that I needed to go home. And then I got a third phone call that day. It was my realtor. He was calling me to let me know that I would be closing on my home in Fairburn on October the 5th.
So this was just before you were closing on a new place?
Yes, ma'am.
And you got home?
Yeah, when I pulled up to the house, it was like a light on. When you pull up to the house, it was like a light on in the kitchen. And I sat out there and I talked to my neighbor. And he was like, "Yeah, Keita, I see you fell weak. You went and picked him up." And I said, "No." I said, "I had to go get him because they say he had shut down on him." And he was like, "Okay, well, that's a good thing. He's home." And he was like, after the conversation ended, he walked away. And I turned around to proceed in the house. And it's like the light was off in the kitchen. So I thought maybe he left out of the kitchen and went somewhere in the house. And I went in the house and I called his name. He didn't answer. I called his name upstairs. He didn't answer. So then I went downstairs and I went to his room. It's like when I got to his room, it's like the clothes that he had taken to the military school. It's like his clothes were separated in anger. And it's like I was still constantly calling his name. I didn't get an answer. And then I went into the weight room that we had downstairs, and that's where I found him. And I ran out of the house, and I was screaming. And it's like people were coming from everywhere.
I am so sorry. It's a devastating, devastating story for, you know, anyone to hear, never mind a mother. But I wonder, you know, so many people who are in family of suicides, they feel guilty. You said earlier, I wish I had responded sooner. But how do you balance that? You know, you want kids to be able to learn their lives and their lessons, and people tell you, oh, they're just sending up a warning flag. How would you advise other families to distinguish when there is a real problem?
It's kind of hard to distinguish because it's like when a person is going through suicidal thoughts, it's like they're just a normal person. You can't see it. But as a parent, I just ask you to just grab your kids, hold on to them, let them know you love them. Because it's just a cruel world that we're living in today. And we have to keep loving our kids because we don't want to allow the streets to love our kids the way we love our kids.
Now, you do have two other children.
Yes.
How do you talk to them about what happened to Marquise?
Well, it's like my kids, they look at the situation and it's like, as long as mom is okay, we're okay.
And how is mama keeping herself okay?
Well, you know, basically, I'm keeping myself okay and astride because what I do is I keep Marquise's name as a legacy. And I give back to the high school which he attended, which is Tri-City High School in East Point, Georgia. I give back book scholarships to kids. I give $800 book scholarships to kids. I give $500 book scholarships for kids. And this is my third year doing this. And, you know, I thank God for allowing me to continue in the pattern in which I'm going. Because if it had not been for the Lord on my side, I can't tell you where I would be.
Now, I asked you about the story not for, you know, morose reasons, but I understand that's part of the healing, that you talk about what actually happened. Has that helped you?
Yes, ma'am. And everything comes day by day, step by step. And sometimes I look at myself and I say, how do I do it?
How do you?
My kids, my granddaughter, they keep me going. And those kids at these high schools, they help me out a lot. And also, there's a principal. He just means so much to me, Mr. Dan Sims. He helped me through it all.
Well, Sharence, I think you're helping others. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for allowing me to come today and share.
Sharence Eccles, if you or somebody you know needs help, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. This is On Second Thought. When fashion designer Kate Spade died last week of an apparent suicide, there was an outpouring of grief from Twitter to the front page of the New York Times. Buying a Kate Spade handbag was a coming-of-age ritual for a generation of American women, declared the Times. That, journalist Farai Chidea pointed out on Twitter, assumes a generation of a woman could afford an exclusive luxury designer bag. Farai Chidea joins me now by Skype from New York to tell us more about what is embedded in that and other coverage. Farai, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, you pointed out on Twitter that the Times dedicated three reporters, front page story, two page spread to Kate Spade. Now, why call that out?
Well, you know, I'm someone who does a lot of research on journalism. I've been a journalist for 27 years, and I've also spent time doing academic research on journalism. And the reality is that American media is fragmenting. I don't think that's a shock to anyone. But part of the reason that I sort of argued in this Twitter thread I did that people don't relate to the news is when you try to universalize something that's just not really universal. I grew up in a working class black neighborhood in Baltimore. My parents were highly educated, but after a divorce, we didn't have a lot of money. And my mom made some of our clothes. We went to Sears and JCPenney. We went to the secondhand store. And part of what my mother taught me, because like all girls, I wanted nice things. She was like, nice things don't define you. Nice things don't make you happy. You can have nice things if you want, but they are not a mark of your self-worth. So by the time I became a young woman, not only could I not afford a lot of designer this and that, I had actually reached the place where I didn't want it. So there's a question of who can even afford, when today the average weekly pre-tax income for an American working woman is less than $800 a week. And a Kate Spade bag costs $200 to $400. So what you're talking about is that, again, that's pre-tax income. You're talking about a minimum of a quarter of the average salary of a working woman in a week. And so let's just be realistic.
Well, so as the Times said, buying a Kate Spade bag was a coming of age ritual for a generation of young women. Obviously not for you.
Not for me. And again, I'm very respectful of the entrepreneurship of Kate Spade. And I was gutted by her death, as I am by people who choose to take their life. And of course, we have also lost Anthony Bourdain. But I still felt it was important to call this out, because what it signals to some people is this article is not written for you, or this news is not written for you. And that's a luxury that American journalism can't afford.
So there's a big assumption of universality, you said earlier. Is anything right. universal in American or global culture that a newspaper can safely write about?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that when you talk about, you know, unfortunately, the suicide of Kate Spade and also of Anthony Bourdain, you can say Americans' lives have been touched by suicide. Whether it's someone you know personally or that your friends have lost someone to suicide, you could make a generalization like that, because life or death issues are essentially universal because it's part of the human experience. The main thing is there's nothing wrong with universality when it's truly universal, but when a kind of fake universal approach is posited, that then excludes members of the audience. And what I saw a lot in responses to this Twitter thread, which became viral, was people in the center of the country saying, oh, that's, you know, why the media doesn't understand us. Like, they're talking about what New Yorkers like. Why should the taste of New Yorkers be something that we assume everyone has? And again, Kate Spade bags were not just New York. But my main thing was that this was an A1 story. This was not a story that was only in the style section. This was considered front page news. The point of this is not about Kate Spade or Kate Spade bags or the New York Times. It's that I really believe the news industry now has to be very careful about how we cultivate a broad audience, because the American news industry is really stretched to have a broad audience, because people are fragmenting to ideologically based publications, age-based publications, and news entities. And if we want there to be a commons of the news as something that connects across race, class, culture, then we have to actually acknowledge that we write for the commons. And if we're not writing for the commons, let's just say that, but we can't have it both ways.
It also speaks to another phenomenon or recent movement of the news business. Of course, they have to monetize everything. And you could argue that Kate Spade, even if people didn't own her bags, she's a brand. She's a brand that people know. Do you think that might have been part of the motivation for the Times to try and draw in as many readers with just a name that felt familiar?
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. So, you know, there's nothing wrong with doing a Kate Spade piece or running it on the A1. My question was more about the framing. I think that what I'm really calling for is for journalists who deliver a mainstream news product designed to at least theoretically be consumed by anyone. And the New York Times in a December memo said that it has 130 million monthly unique readers, you know, people from around the world. So if you're dealing with an audience that big and that heterogeneous, just don't pretend that everyone in it is the same. If some of news is the commons, we have to make sure that it's welcoming to everyone and that we have a place for everyone. And seemingly insignificant social cues actually do bring people into the orbit of paying attention to the news or push them out. If you imply that your audience, everyone fits into one bucket or the other, that then makes people feel excluded. And it's, I think, critical to our mission as journalists to really consider who we invite to the table for content.
Farai Chidea, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Farai Chidea, she's a journalist and journalism program officer at the Ford Foundation. And we continue talking about representation with what happens when a white student attends an historically black college. That's just ahead. This is On Second Thought. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Department of Veterans Affairs reports that on any given night, more than 40,000 veterans live on American streets. Savannah is trying out one solution, building tiny houses. And we're going to learn about those plans on tomorrow's show. But we would like to hear from you first. How do you think cities and towns can help homeless people? And have you ever been homeless? You can call us at 404-500-9457. You can find us on Twitter, on Facebook at OST Talk. And please be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. for more. Atlanta's Morehouse College is one of the nation's most distinguished historically black colleges and universities. And now it's recruiting white students.
Walking down Brown Street and having people acknowledging you and affirming you, that's something that they do here. And I love that part of the culture shock.
They're black students, they're black artists.
This place is sacred.
I think this is a safe space for black students.
And if we had white people just coming in here, I will feel disrespected.
That is from Vice.com's new Minority Report series. The first episode follows a white student at Morehouse and the response of other students. Lee Adams is producer for the series, and he's joining us from New York. Hello, Lee.
Hello, Virginia. Thanks so much for having me today.
Why is Morehouse recruiting white students?
It comes down to a question of dollars. A lot of HBCUs are struggling, and they're turning to the recruitment of the non-traditional student, as they call them, as a means of financial sustainability moving into the future.
So we're going to hear more about the sustainability of HBCUs, SUs in a moment. But you follow Tiago Rachelson. Now, he's a white freshman at Morehouse. Here he is telling you about why he applied. You spent some time with Tiago. What was your impression of him? What motivated him to be the white guy at Morehouse?
That question, obviously, that was a question on everyone's mind when we first sat down with him. And that was a question on my mind when I first spoke with him. And his answer was that, you know, he wanted something new and different, but that he also felt a calling to Morehouse because of the mission of the institution to produce leaders. What's interesting about that is Morehouse is known for producing the great black leaders of America and preparing those minds for entering a world that seeks to rob them of their dignity and their sense of self-worth kind of at every step. So it's interesting to hear a member of the majority feel this calling so deeply.
So let's hear Tiago get that clip lined up now.
The most fundamental change, right, out of everything is turning me away from a self-absorbed experience. Decentralizing the attitude of whiteness, right? The attitude that I'm smarter, that I deserve this opportunity more than you, the attitude of supremacy.
So he sounds pretty self-aware. Do you get the sense that he feels like, you know, one of the nice white guys?
I think that his natural desire to take the lessons that he's learning and bring them back into the communities that he can navigate freely to hopefully initiate change is very admirable. And to hear such a young person acknowledge the privilege that he was born with and want to challenge that and use it for change, I think is good. He's definitely idealistic, to say the least.
Well, for you, so you heard some feedback from people at Morehouse saying, why are you focusing on the one white guy? You know, we've got a huge school here. What was your reason for that?
It's interesting because a lot of the mainstream media attention that is given to black schools often, well, actually, let me take a step back and just say that they don't really get the recognition that I think they deserve. And what I was concerned with doing, especially as a young black man whose family actually attended Morehouse, I didn't want to go there and champion the one white perspective that was present at the school. I wanted to allow them to drive their own narrative, but I felt that this was a way to at least cater to an audience that maybe is marginalized in the way that the mainstream media, you know, the way that the representation that they receive from the mainstream media.
So we do see Tiago playing video games, hanging out with other students, and the students from Morehouse seem to welcome him as a friend in person. Others caught wind of what you were doing, and they wanted to talk to you. Here's a little bit of that response.
I'm on the fence about it. What's taught here is not only how we fight for it, for where we are, but how we fight for who we are outside of these gates.
If you grew up in an environment where you were mistreated and abused and just, you know, belittled by white people, you really don't want to see them when you come to a black space.
That bothers me because we have to provide a safe haven for our children.
So we hear a lot of that, this idea of the concept of Morehouse as a safe space, and historically it was. Do you, being there doing this documentary, get the sense that that still feels essential, critical, and necessary?
I do. And I think one of the key points of this documentary is to remind people that, you know, these schools were originally established and intended to cater to a black community that was excluded from predominantly white institutions around the country. And as we have seen hate emboldened in this country again, those safe spaces are more necessary now than ever before. Especially as a young black man in America, when you're being disproportionately targeted by police in instances of violence, you want that physical safety, that emotional safety to be reacquainted with your blackness and your identity, and the freedom to be challenged intellectually by educators that look like you.
So if that boundary is broken down between having a safe space for African-American students and then inviting whites, other people, other minorities in order to make more money for Morehouse, what do you think the school and the students have to lose or to gain?
I think hopefully they're in a position to just have the money to maintain operations, because we've seen other HBCUs close down or lose their accreditation due to financial struggles. The things that they do have to worry about are when you look at schools like West Virginia State or Bluefield State, schools that are HBCUs but have a black population of less than 10% among their student body, that has to fundamentally shift the culture of the institution. And it compromises that culturally safe space that it was intended to be in the first place.
But there is the argument that in order for our culture to really confront racism, to really talk about race, we need people to step out of their comfort zones. And that may be Tiago and maybe African-American students at Morehouse. I mean, are HBCUs a safe place for that?
I think they're definitely a place that encourage that dialogue and conversation. And with Minority Reports, that was exactly the question that we wanted to ask, is how can we create this conversation around race in a way that's going to be beneficial and constructive for everyone? I think the thing that's important to remember about the black student who seeks out that four-year experience at an HBCU, every day they walk out of the house, they're navigating that same conversation. They're always sort of being tasked with being the cultural ambassador for Black America when you're one of few. And there are white spaces in society and there are black spaces in society. And something that is important is that this is a very, very brief four-year reprieve from that sort of confrontation with that conversation that you're tasked with every day as a black person in America.
Lee Adams, producer of Minority Reports, a new series upcoming on Vice.com. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Virginia.
There's more in the series, which begins on June 19th at gpbnews.org. For more than a century, historically black colleges and universities have graduated many dynamic and influential people. But some educators worry a quarter of these schools could be gone within the next 20 years. Filmmaker Stanley Nelson produced a PBS documentary this year about the legacy of HBCUs. He spoke with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headley. Nelson says some HBCUs were started by white people, and their motives didn't always have to do with racial equality.
There was a knowledge, especially in the North, from what were called missionary societies, that you know, you have this population of millions of African Americans who were freed by the Civil War and who are not educated, and so there was this idea that they have to be educated. But there was also this thought by many of them that African Americans were not really equal to white folks, and you know, we'll educate them in what way we can. But they are not equal to white folks.
And the man who founded Hampton University really wanted to teach African Americans in the trades.
Right. That was one of the things that came out of this idea that African Americans were not equal, is this idea of what was called industrial education, which was an education for service. So, you know, we'll educate African Americans to be great cooks and great carpenters and great bricklayers and leather workers and those kind of things to in fact, you know, kind of perform the same duties that they performed, you know, under enslavement, basically.
So I want to play this comment from Mary Beth Gassman, who directs the Penn Center for Minority-Serving Institutions at the University of Pennsylvania. And this is a comment that she made when she was on the podcast, Historically Black.
It isn't a good idea to think of them as all alike, because they're not. The one thing that they have in common is that they, at their core, they were all started to engage in racial uplift and support African Americans.
Is that the one common thread? Because coming away from your documentary, it's clear that the history of HBCUs is really diverse. But were they all started to uplift the race?
I think so. I mean, if you look at simply getting an education as uplifting the race, so you know, some institutions might be more political minded than the next, but I think they were all started to uplift the race. Again, if you broaden that term to mean, you know, educate the race, and I think a part of the kind of politicalness, if you will, of HBCUs has come from the students, and that's come over time.
Another thing that may be surprising, well, it was surprising to me anyway, was the pushback that some cities had that didn't want these schools in their communities.
Yeah, there's an incredible sequence in the film where black people try to start a school in New Haven, Connecticut, the home of Yale. And this is before the Civil War, and basically the town uprises, the mayor and the town uprises, and no, you can't have a college here to educate black people. That'll you know, ruin our city if you bring black people here who want to have a college education. Again, that's how fearful education was.
So then let's fast forward just a little bit and talk about the effect that it had when African Americans were finally able to go to these schools and get their degree. And it appears that it had more than just the value of the degree. This is Dorothy Smith that you spoke with. She's an alum of Bennett College, an HBCU in North Carolina. And she remembers being interviewed to attend Wilson College first, which was a non-HBCU school.
I have not forgotten her words. Your grades are wonderful, but we're a little concerned because we don't know with whom you would be paired, because we cater to a lot of Southern gentlewomen and they room in suites. Sorry, kid. So I didn't get to Wilson. I applied to Bennett for a scholarship. It was kind of special.
So what did you hear about the effect that having these HBCUs had on, I guess, the morale of a generation?
Well, you know, that also is very personal for me. My parents both went to HBCUs. My mother went to Talladega in Alabama. And my father, who he and his brother were the first people in his family to graduate high school in Washington, D.C., he went on to go to Howard University and then went to Howard Dental School. And it was only because HBCUs gave him an opportunity to go to college, that he went to college. This was in the 1930s and 40s, that he went to college. It was only because HBCUs provided this nurturing environment where they told him, you know, you can do it. You know, this will work. You can do it. That he was able to go on and live the life that he lived, which allows me to have the life that I live and my kids' lives that they live and on down through the generations because HBCUs were there for him.
So when Booker T. Washington became a president of a university, he was the only black person to head one of these schools. When did the tide sort of begin to turn in terms of having a mostly black faculty and administration at some of these schools?
Yeah, well, we tell a great story about Fisk University in the 20s, and the students there kind of uprise against the draconian measures that are instituted by the president, the white president there, who, you know, he won't let the students, male and female students, walk together. They can't even walk together. He does away with fraternities, sororities, a lot of the sports teams. And the students hold a strike, you know, they hold a strike for weeks and weeks, and finally he has to resign. And I think at that point, you know, students of HBCUs across the country realize that they have power and that the schools really have to adjust to them and adjust and change with the times. And so the schools begin to change. One of the great things, the interesting points about Fisk is that the guy, the president who succeeded the president that was ousted was also white, but he was much more in tune with the students.
Let's hear another comment. Edward Waters College is the oldest HBCU in Florida, and college president Nathaniel Glover is actually a graduate of the school from 1966. He was Florida's first black sheriff since Reconstruction, and here he is speaking to WFSU Radio that he views his role as an educator, much the same as he viewed his role as sheriff in terms of saving lives.
Some of these students would never see the light of day if they didn't have Edward Waters College. And you know what? I am one of those students. It was almost like vindication being able to come back as the president of a college after having made a career of arresting young people. It is the epitome of redemption, I think.
This was what he's talking about is something that was echoed from a number of people in your documentary. And I wonder if you think that was that view of HBCUs was generational. That one of the reasons HBCUs are struggling is because the younger generation doesn't see them as a lifeline.
You know, I mean, I think that first I want to say that a lot of HBCUs and probably the majority of them are not struggling. You know, I mean, we went to probably 30 HBCUs with this film, and these are, you know, strong, incredible institutions. You know, they have, you know, huge buildings and, you know, libraries, and they are, you know, viable institutions. But I think some of these and some HBCUs are struggling is because partially, you know, they're not supported as they should be by alumni, and not supported as they should be by the general community.
That was filmmaker Stanley Nelson speaking with GPB special correspondent Celeste Headlee. Stanley Nelson's PBS documentary is called Tell Them We Are Rising, the Story of Black Colleges and Universities. And that is our show for today. We do always want to hear from you. If you attend an HBCU, tell us which school and why you chose to go there. You can call us at 404-500-9457. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Virginia Prescott.